The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 15, 2005. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Well, this morning I thought what I would talk about is how Dharma teaching is a little different than ordinary teaching. Though very often we confuse Dharma teaching with ordinary teaching, and that can lead to some difficulty. Some of what we might call Dharma teaching, teaching of truth, reality, some of that resembles regular teaching. But we take it all to be regular teaching, and then we make a big mistake, I think. We get confused by the teaching. It takes us a long time to really understand what this teaching is about and what it's trying to do. Basically, there's three kinds of Dharma teaching, we could say. Really, there's only one, but we could say there's three kinds. And for lack of a better word, I'll say that they're positive, negative, and neutral. Now, the real teaching, that's neutral. And the real teaching, the true teaching, true Dharma teaching, is actually, it's neutral because it's silent. Nothing is actually said. Because if the teaching is about truth, reality is about actual truth, not made up truth, not a story of truth. So anytime we say something, immediately, well, it's not exactly truth. It's just something captured, something held to, something believed in. So actual true Dharma teaching, the teaching of the awakened, is, strictly speaking, silence. It just so happens, though, that everything, if we say, you know, you are Buddha, you know, well, how is that? Well, because you actually teach, demonstrate truth, reality all the time. How could you not? Everything does. You know, the floor, the light in the room, the sounds, the colors. Everything is teaching. You know, Dogen, a beautiful phrase where he said, the color of the peak, the sound of the valley, all are Shakyamuni's voice and figure. And what he means by that is that this is all the voice and figure, the teaching of Dharma, of reality, of truth. It is all. The color of the peak, the sound of the valley are all teaching constantly. All is showing us reality all the time. And we're not removed from this. We're a part of this. So silently, we are always demonstrating, presenting truth, reality. But we step into it with our intention, you know, and we start to, what can I say, corrupt it? Where we're trying to get hold of it in some way. Immediately it's no longer truth just as it is. It's truth as we're trying to make it, trying to present it, as we buy it ourselves. So this is kind of a problem. Well, how do we show this teaching? How do we present Buddha? In the Mahayana, the Buddha is always presented as, they're silent. They never say, like in the Sutra, the Heart Sutra, the Buddha's sitting there, but he never says anything. Avalokiteshvara is talking, Manjushri is talking, Subhuti is talking, and all these different sutras, different people, Shariputra, they're doing all the talking. The Buddha just sits there, never says anything. Yeah, once in a while. I think there's a few places where we get a few words. But basically, the Buddhas are silent. And as soon as we say something, as soon as something's put into words, there could be intention there. Something's being formed, something's being shaped. Then we get into something either positive or negative. But actual Dharma isn't like that. And it is always here, just waiting for us to notice, to take it up, to see it, to realize it directly ourselves. that's why we have, here's our Buddha here, you see. Just a stone. And just teaching. Just presenting reality, just as you or I or this floor or anything else is presenting reality to us. But the reason I have just a stone here is, of course, if I start telling you my reasons, now that starts to become something corrupt again, you see. We have to be very careful here, but nevertheless, just this stone here, the stone wasn't intended by anybody. The stone is just formed out of the workings of the universe without intention, broken up from a mountain range north of here, the old Laurentians, pushed down here by glaciers tens of thousands of years ago and left in a field out here where we found it. And the guy, I've told the story before, he didn't want to sell us the pretty stones that he had in this field. He didn't want to sell, so he just gave it to us. Beautiful, perfect. It's just a potato, he called it a potato rock. It wasn't a pretty rock. Perfect for a Buddha. And how can you buy something like that? So he gave it to us. Wonderful. And we put it up here. And when it sits here, you see, it teaches. It presents something. It shows the stability of a Buddha, one who's present, awake here. It kind of reminds us of that still point in our own mind, that steadiness that we can find. It's there. If we know how to look for it, if we think to look for it, if we make some effort to look for that, we'll find that. But that is that's the Buddha right here within our where we're sitting right here. And this kind of reminds us of that. But if we were to carve a Buddha, you know, kind of a humanoid figure sitting there, well, then immediately now we're suggesting something. It's starting to become something a little bit more positive. It isn't just formed by the forces of nature, of reality. It is something a little bit more directed. Of course, just our very taking it out of a field and putting it up here contributes a certain amount of that. A little dangerous there. So now it's teaching. But what's happened there is all we've done is kind of directed our attention to it a little bit. Give a little bit of prominence. But all the while, for tens of thousands of years, millions of years perhaps, this boulder's been sitting there preaching the Dharma for millions of years. Nobody perhaps was paying any attention. And we weren't really paying attention until we deliberately went out in the field and looked for some boulders. And this one, no more than any of the others, but this is the one that we chose to drag in here. And we set it up. Now, of course, it could become something special. But it doesn't have to be. No more special than anything else, because everything is preaching, teaching the Dharma reality, including you right now as you sit here. So it's always when we step in with our intention, our desire to control, to bring about some ends, to get something across, anything of this sort, this is when we begin to corrupt it. And what we say now isn't really quite the truth. Of course, we're well-meaning. We want to help people with that. We want ourselves to be steeped in the truth, centered in the truth. Of course, we forget that we already are. We forget that we can just trust that. And we get focused on something else out there and we begin to reach toward that or whatever. And we want to say something, we want to direct something, we want to control something. So now we enter into this kind of a positive kind of teaching. By the way, I was going to say this about Tomoe, my teacher's widow. When she, on her first visit here after we had installed the stone, I wasn't too sure what she would say. It was, like when I was in Japan, everywhere it's just Buddha statues. And finally I saw a place with a stone. That's where I got this idea. Oh, immediately I thought, oh, that's... But I put it up here and Tomoe didn't know it, I don't think. I don't think anybody tipped her off. But anyway, she came around the corner and looked into the room and immediately saw the stone. And, oh, she said, you know. And she kind of put her hands like this and she turned to me with a big smile and she said, best one. Best one, yeah. And it is pretty good because you see a stone can just sit there and teach. We don't really think too much of the stone. Stone's not trying to do something. It's not trying to be something special, not trying to be a pretty stone, like a pretty Buddha or something like that. It's just there. But of course what it's there with, everything is there with the same thing. It's reality. And so we don't need to do anything extra, anything special to put on ourselves or on this teaching or anything else. It's all right there. It's a matter for each one of us in our own heart and mind to notice reality, to notice what's going on right here. But as I said, we will step into things with a little bit of intention. And as my teacher said too, Buddha just sitting here, the stone, the floor, you, anything. It just sits here in silence. And of course, as I said, for millions of years, the stone just sitting there in silence, and maybe nobody's paying attention. Of course, there probably weren't too many people around, and I don't know about the cognitive levels of the animals and creatures that might have been around, or how long the stone had been buried, or any of these things. But nevertheless, everything is just sitting there quietly, always teaching. And in this silence, it's human beings that come along because we have these incredible minds, you know. Don't want to speculate on animal minds, but I know, because I'm a human being, I know that we, you know this, that we have these minds that can conceptualize, grasp our experience into thought. And we're very much taken by that. So, because we pay so much attention to that, we ignore all of this stuff that sits around in silence and teaches us the truth, teaches us Dharma. So as my teacher said, then if you just sit here in silence, you don't say anything, just like a Buddha, yes, you're demonstrating reality and truth. Yeah, but at some point, maybe you need to say something. Because as he put it, he said, if you don't say anything, nobody will understand. Very few of us spontaneously awaken to what is just right here. So it's helpful for us. It certainly was in my case, meeting my teacher and being exposed to all this wonderful teaching down through the ages, Nagarjuna and Dogen, Buddha and others. So we need this. We need this kind of help. And so the teaching comes out of just being silence, and now it can go these two different ways, positive, negative. And most teaching that we encounter, and this is what we confuse with Dharma teaching, we think of it as ordinary teaching. Ordinary teaching is positive. I suppose there could be some negative forms, but not too much of that. Meaning that if something's being taught, something's being demonstrated, here, this is what you should think. This is what you should believe. This is what you should do. And this is how it's done. This is what it is. And, you know, this kind of this positive stuff. And this is very helpful for us. You know, born into this world knowing really not very much about the world, helpful for us to run into a positive teaching, you know. Directs our attention to one thing or another. And we need this. But when we think that we can somehow talk about the truth, you know, like in religion or science, we're about the business of truth. We think that somehow we can capture it in a word or a phrase. No, it can't be done. Because whatever we say, whatever we point to, is something pulled out of the whole. It is something kind of corrupted. In itself, it's not corrupt, but it's corrupt in what we do with it. We will grasp it. We will try to make it into one thing or another. Well, this is the positive aspects of teaching. And pretty much all the teaching that we find in Buddhism, most of it of the verbal sort, is actually negative. And we don't understand that. You know, so we take it to be positive. We take the teaching as though it was being offered, as if it were something for us to figure out, to get hold of, to believe in, to, form some kind of structure in our mind for our life out of this teaching. And that's not it at all. But there is this element of positive teaching that we offer in Buddhism, in Dharma teaching. It's very simple. We've offered it here. It's basically like meditation instruction, for example. This is how we sit. This is the kind of posture that we take. This is how you focus on your mind. Things of this sort. So it's like it's very practical kind of stuff. You know, and we talk about how we step into the room and how we approach our the cushion and bowing to the cushion. All these different things. So this kind of positive teaching. Do it this way. And we offer this without any justification or explanation for it generally. People wonder, well, why do we do this? Well, we could start to offer a few things. But, of course, everything you say is just so much blah, blah, blah. But sometimes it'll pacify us enough to just settle us down so we can just sit down and then just start doing this teaching. I mean, this meditation, say, if it's meditation. And there we learn about the meditation through the doing of it. We don't really learn about it by having somebody explain it to you. We can explain, you know, well, why don't you sit like this? Why don't you focus your mind? You want to be in an alert posture. You want to be stable, calm, and focused. Watch all the, you know, so we can point out these kinds of things. But then that's about it. In the end, that's just something to help us kind of pick it up and to start doing this. And when you start doing it, it's like learning to ride a bicycle. I could point out a few things for you. Maybe even demonstrate it a little bit or whatever, but it's until you get on the bicycle yourself and start to move and you realize, hey, you know, I can balance, hey, no problem here. All this kind of stuff that we might have been thinking about and worrying about and thinking, well, I can't do that. But if you just go ahead and do it, you start to find out what it is. And as you ride that bike a little more, pretty soon you can get a little finesse there and you could, you know, bank around the corners and things. You can do all this sort of stuff. Wow, didn't know I could do it. But you learn that through doing. Through taking it up and doing. And so the teaching just only acts as something just to kind of, out of this huge world of everything, and we can just focus in on a few points, try this, do this, and see what happens now. So that's the positive aspect of the teaching. The rest of it, for the most part, is what we might call a negative aspect. But because we so rarely run into the negative teaching, let's put it that way, we're not familiar with it, and we'll take it to be something positive. So we have teaching, well, the Buddha likened his teaching to a raft, something to help you, but don't get hold of it like it's something. But we'll get hold of it nevertheless. You know, then it becomes something kind of corrupt. A few weeks ago in our practice period, Trish had brought in this board. It's called a Zen board, right? Where you write something on this board. And then as she talked, she was talking on No Trace, you know, from Suzuki Roshi's book. And slowly it evaporated away. By the time her talk was done, there was nothing on the board. No trace, you know, nothing at all. Zen board. I got to get one of those. But this is kind of how we offer the tea. I used to liken it to writing on a chalkboard and then coming along with an eraser and the other hand taking it off. This is a negative kind of teaching. Because in the end, we don't want to give you something. A teacher, at least who's the awakened, they don't want to give us anything. Because anything that you get hold of and walk away with, that's something that's been pulled out from reality itself. Helpful, wonderful in many ways. We can appreciate these things, perhaps, but when we believe this, we hold onto this as if somehow we got our hands on the truth here, we make a big mistake. So the teachings are always directing us in this way. Those of you who have studied Nagarjuna with me here now, you know, that's what we find. We get a lot of this with Nagarjuna. But people want to know, well, what's he getting at? What's the point? What am I supposed to grasp out of this? Well, nothing, really. We can't believe, but you're going to have this huge, elaborate teaching, and it's so hard to study this. Why is it hard? It's hard because you keep trying to grasp it. And all he's doing is, you know, every chapter in that book that we study is examination of this, examination of that, every chapter title is examination of something. We're not paying attention to just what that means. He's just saying, just look at this. Look at this. Look at what? Well, look at what you think about such and such. You hold up some idea, some belief, See, we have the positive kind of teaching. We'll hold it up. Here, trust this, believe this. You see, but he'll say, no, look at that. This is a negative teaching. Just look at that. Notice how it's contradictory. Notice how it doesn't match reality. It doesn't match your actual experience if we look at it carefully. It can't be true. And that's all that this teaching ultimately is doing. Then in the end, the teaching says, okay, goodbye, I'm out of here. Nothing left, you see? So it's kind of, it works like that. But we're used to having the positive stuff. We want to get hold of something. Suzuki Roshi, when he says, when my talk is over, your listening is over, you don't need to remember what I said. We went, what? Because we want to get hold of something here. But we don't realize that all the while we're immersed in reality, in the truth. Nothing to say there. Nothing to get hold of. But it is helpful for us to have our attention directed back to this reality, that it is just like this. And we can't get hold of it, that you see it directly. You see it for yourself. I can't see it for you. No one can see it for you. You have to see it directly for yourself. And in fact, you actually do. That's the other, that's the beautiful part. You don't have to train yourself into seeing something, or to fool yourself into seeing something or anything of this sort. You see it now. What we are confused about is that we keep reaching for something, we keep jabbering to ourselves and telling ourselves something. And we're following that instead of what's actually being experienced. And when this teaching is offered, this negative teaching is offered to get us to notice what we're doing, we keep grabbing hold of the teaching. Buddha likened his teaching to a finger pointing to the moon. Instead of looking at the moon, we keep grasping and reaching for the finger that's doing the pointing. We become fascinated by the teaching or the teacher or the books or the robes or the garments or the this or that. There's all kinds of stuff that we can get hold of. This is where we go every time. So we allow our minds to get taken in by one thing or another. I have this beautiful little quote here by Takawan, who is a brilliant teacher, 17th century Japan, I believe, roughly about that time, I think. And in this letter he wrote to one of his students, who is in the Rinzai tradition, but in a letter he wrote to one of his students who later became a master of the sword, Takuan offered this teaching. He said, if you direct your mind toward the bodily movements of your opponent, your mind will be taken by the bodily movements of your opponent. If you direct your mind toward your opponent's sword, it will be taken by the sword. If you direct your mind toward trying to strike your opponent, it will be taken by waiting to strike. If you direct your mind toward your own sword, it will be taken by your sword. If you direct your mind toward not being struck, it will be taken by the desire not to be struck. If you direct your mind toward your opponent's attitude, it will be taken by his attitude. In short, there is nowhere to direct your mind. In short, there's nowhere to direct your mind. We'll hear something like this, and yet, almost right away, we'll think something like, okay, so where should I direct my mind? This is what we do. And I know that sounds funny, and it is kind of funny, but it's true. Because I've seen this with students over and over and over again. I've experienced it myself, too. Same thing, same kind of foolishness. Foolish in being fooled. We're told something directly, he'll say, and he gives these examples, and we can follow all of that. And then he'll say, in short, there's nowhere to direct your mind. But because we always have to, we want something positive there, that we're used to, this is how we operate, we'll go, okay, so now, where do I direct my mind? That's where we'll go. Takes us a while, maybe years really, to start to realize that when he said, in short, there's nowhere to direct your mind, that he means that in short, There's nowhere to direct your mind. Because whenever you do, you will be taken by that. So it means that the awakened, those who wake up to reality, they're not taken by anything. They see things just as well as you or I. They can conceptualize too. There's this and there's that, and they might even reach for things, but then they can also let go. They experience feelings and thoughts and impressions and bodily sensations and objects and smells and all everything that we experience. No different. But they can let it wash through. Nowhere to direct your mind. It all comes up to you. It's a matter of just being ready. Every moment's fresh, new. But we don't have to take hold of something. If we do take hold of something, maybe provisionally, just for a moment, and then we let it go. We're talking about the teaching. We're talking about your own life. We're talking about reality. About your loved ones, we want to get hold of them and kind of some kind of strange way possess them. Oh no, I don't. I love them. And oh yeah, but it is a kind of a possession that gets into that somehow. If we truly love them, we trust that here they are, and every moment washes through fresh and new. And we can be open to all of this. This is the subtlety of it, and this is where we miss it. So when we listen to this teaching, you should understand that for the most part, it is directing our attention to noticing how it is that we keep grasping, that we keep trying to make something of it. We direct our mind to this and that, and then our mind is taken. We are taken by that object, that thing, that desire, that whatever it is. And we don't understand, and we'll treat this teaching in that same way. But this teaching, as I said, the positive side is this, just to, you know, just sit down, focus your mind. Here's a few things you can do. There's not too much in that area. And even there, that's just temporary, because once you start to do that, you'll learn and just the doing will teach you. The rest of it is directing our attention into how we get ourselves caught. But then we allow ourselves to get caught by that very teaching that is just pointing out, you know, how we allow ourselves to get caught. We can trust that there's no place to direct our mind. Our mind is just here, in other words, present, open, awake with each moment. Thinking can occur. We can let it wash through. We need to think. We need to feel. There's no, whether we need to or not, we do. But we don't need to grasp. We don't need to cling. We don't need to think that we've gotten hold of something here. We think we need to get hold of that thing. You know, so where should I direct my mind? We want to get hold of something there. Because we think somehow that will give us some kind of stability or satisfaction or something. Peace of mind. But it doesn't. We can start to notice that every time you grasp, it doesn't give you any of those things that you were looking for as you reached, as you grasped. There's nowhere to direct your mind because you are already in the midst of reality itself. In fact, it's not even that. That you are no different than nothing removed from reality itself. Truth itself, Dharma itself. In realizing this directly yourself, which actually you already do, you are Buddha. I say that you already do, and you already are Buddha. We say this. Why do I not? Because you are in the midst of that, you are still reaching and grasping. Just as the stone, in spite of itself, teaches reality, you sitting here teach, you know, you exude reality. You are reality. So nothing there, nothing's missing, nothing's lacking here. where we go wrong is that we'll make something up, we'll tell ourselves something, and we'll reach for that, and we'll spend our time there, oblivious to what is actually going on. It takes us a long time to first understand what we're even saying here about this. Just as Takuan, he says, know where to direct your mind. And we'll understand it quite well. We think, oh yeah, I get it. Oh, that boy, that's cool. You know, I like that. You know, but then we'll immediately say, where do I direct my mind? And we won't notice that we're doing that. But in the refinement of this teaching and in understanding it, we have to start to notice that. And to realize then how this teaching is being presented. This teaching is never being presented to you in a way that's intended for you to get hold of it. As if you can walk away with something. I think it was Baijiang, one of the great teachers, talked about how sometimes a teacher will hand you a chain. Because anything that's actually handed to you is a chain. It's bondage. And we'll take it and we'll say, oh, thank you very much. And we'll strap it on. We'll bind ourselves up with it. Because that's what we're looking for. We're looking for, or at least that's what we think we're looking for. We're really looking for truth. But you don't need to look for truth, reality, because it's right here. And it's because we spend so much time looking, we bind ourselves into chains and we think we have to keep searching and digging. This teaching is always directing our attention back to noticing what we're doing now, in this moment. It doesn't involve things like blaming and shaming and any of these kinds of things. It's a matter of just notice this. And in some little moment when you realize your confusion, nothing to blame there. You did something out of confusion. You caused some hurt, some pain, some difficulty in your life or the lives of others. What's to blame? You were confused. Now you're not. So stop. Just stop. Just end it now. Just let it all end. Here we are. It's very simple. Now we're all forgiven. Nothing to forgive. We're all without blame. Nothing to blame here. But there is this matter of confusion. You know, in Buddhism, we don't talk about sin. We don't have this concept in Buddhism. But we do talk about ignorance. Our problem is that we ignore what's actually going on. And we do it, that's our pain, that's our suffering. That's the world of dukkha that we create. So this is just a kind of a subtle aspect to the teaching then that I wanted to bring out. So I think sometimes maybe I don't say enough about the Dharma teaching itself directly. To remind you, just realize this is not ordinary teaching. It's not meant for you to get hold of it. Nothing to get hold of. In the end, when I think about it, what's my teacher? What did I get hold of? I don't know. I can't tell you. I don't think I got hold of anything in the end. But had I not met that catalyst, I don't know that I could have worked it through myself. But that's where it comes, it does come back to you. You got to work on it. You got to do it. And we are all so fortunate that we've got this teaching, that we've got this long history. We've got people who have worked it through themselves, people like Takuan here, who just in some simple way really point to it directly. We're all very fortunate that we have this. And we should appreciate that. But we should never hold it up like it's something special or royal or... We don't need to bow down to it. We appreciate it deeply from the heart. And the true appreciation of it is now just take it up yourself and do this. You get on the bicycle and learn to ride. Okay, well, that's probably all I have to say this morning. But do you have any questions about anything I said here?
Yes.
Yeah.
When I some particular way of... teaching some things have come up. There are many instances of that for different classes. Or if there's koans coming up for a session on next week's Maya Abhidharma. And I study these things. But I noticed this morning that I really want to try and grab onto it and have it memorized. Even if I do that, I always forget it all. It doesn't it's only a short-term memory. It's not a test, and it won't work.
Yeah.
And
fortunately, we don't give exams, so you don't. Well, I used to teach at St. Olaf College, and that was the real drag of that thing. I had to give exams, and it was terrible, you know. It's much better to just offer it like this, and you don't have to test anybody. Besides, it's your business. But yeah, there's nothing there. You're going to learn this, you memorize it, whatever. No, you just kind of spit it back. But do you understand it? Have you taken it up? Have you digested it? Are you living it? Do you really understand what these teachers have been pointing out to us? And that's when we're getting down to the issue here. This is what we're dealing with. This is what it's about. The other stuff is just kind of superficial. It's just intellection. It's just grasping. It's just conceptualizing. It's just hanging on. And the world of conceptualization is necessary. We certainly need it. But it doesn't apply here. It doesn't apply to actually understanding our lives, understanding reality. So we can relax about all that. Nobody's ever going to test you on that. Not God or Buddha or the universe itself won't give you the exam where you got to start writing out the answers. It doesn't work that way. So as you're studying this stuff, you know, I used to be that way too, or I'd get frustrated because I couldn't remember things, you know. Why, you know, and it all seemed so complicated and sometimes even boring, mainly because I didn't understand what I was wading through. Why I kept it up, I don't know, but I'm glad I did. Something else was going on. Just kind of coming up behind me, something just kind of like this. It wasn't, I'm thinking I've got to pick up stuff out here, and something else just kind of comes up, and the next thing you know, you're in it. Oh, what happened here? And it's just sort of, vague at first. But after a while, we start to understand. And so we can relax. And you encounter that statement by Suzuki where he says, you don't need to remember what I said. Like today, you walk out of here, you won't remember what I said, you know. You might think it's a good talk, you might think it was a bad talk, doesn't really matter. And you won't really remember. And we're making a recording of it. You can come back and listen to it again, if you want. And then you can forget about it over again, see. But little by little. See, we do this over and over again. We think, well, I'm not getting it. Well, yeah, but you know, it's not about getting something anyway, and we're told that. So this can at least be a clue for you to just relax. But come back to it, and come back to it, and come back to it, and come back to it. Something quietly would just kind of overtake you. It'll be, what is it? It's understanding. It's waking up to what's really going on. It's been going on all along. But for our trying to get hold of things and figure it out and have an idea about it, we keep missing it, you know. So the real important thing to remember here is just come back to it. See, a lot of times people, they get discouraged because at first we encounter this teaching as, wow, fresh, you know, different, and it's kind of startling in some ways, and we're kind of taken by that. And then we enter into this murky stuff, and we're, you know, and a lot of times people can get discouraged. Some people right away is like, I don't know, that's any number of things can happen. But this is what you need to do. You just stay with it. Come back to it. Come back to it. Come back to it. That's how we find that will help us greatly to finally wake up and to see. And you'll see, it's never in what's ever been presented, really. Because it's the voice of the sound of the valley and the color of the peak. You know, it's all just right here. Been there all along. Yes?
Kind of a follow-up question to that. When you are discouraged or you're, and you do things like work on a mantra or calling or even like counting your breaths or things like that, is based upon that, is that inherently less challenging or so, or is that, is it inherently better to just work through the discouragement and try to like really focus on emptying your thoughts than using some sort of like technique, for lack of a better term? Is that
Well, first of all, don't focus on emptying your thoughts. You know, you can't empty your thoughts. The thoughts will go away. They don't last anyway. That's their nature, is to come and go. So let them. and don't be worried about it. Just notice when a thought's passing by, just notice it, but don't do anything about it. Just, it'll go. Yeah, so really it's a matter of just learning to just kind of, just hands off. But be present with it. Bring yourself back to it. You know, that's all we need to do. And if you get discouraged, well, where is this discouragement coming from? The discouragement, if you notice, that there's that grasping mind at work. So we can take a look at that. Also, be aware that discouragement, I think, is probably just par for the course. I certainly experienced a lot of it. I know my teacher did. I'm sure Norm would attest to that. And well, any number of you, I'm sure, will. Just don't let it stop you. I got so discouraged. 3 times I quit, kind of. But fortunately, I never quit for more than about 24 hours at the most, you know. You know, but so just come back to it again. Just come back. And that's kind of normal. But that discouragement, that's a real clear signal for us to notice our grasping mind. That's what's involved with that. And then you start to see the outlines of that. Get familiar with that. Know, recognize that for what it is. And realize that this isn't necessary at all. It's coming out of our confusion, you see. When the masters say that there's nothing to get, they mean that. Then where should I direct my mind? We stay on that line and then we don't get this at all. But what they're telling us is, you know, the whole game plan that you're operating in is just wrong. And how do we get out of that? Well, first to recognize what you're doing and to realize what that is. What's the best way to do it? Just stay with this. Just come back to it. Come back to it. Come back to it. And start to recognize the outlines, at least, of this grasping mind of ours.
It's almost better to just live with it.
Yeah, just live with it. Yeah. Okay. Discouragement comes. All right. Just stay with it. You know, even now I get discouraged. I get discouraged all the time. Not about Dharma, but I recognize. I know what it is. I'll have some fancy idea about Dharma field, what we got to do here. Then I get discouraged, you see. Well, then I realize what I'm doing. I've got some idea here. So this is it's a good signal. These kinds of things just kind of signal our delusion and our confused mind. And we can learn to appreciate those. We can catch it. Now we can start to catch them before they flare up into something huge. And oh my gosh, you know, now we're taken in by all that. Little by little, we can start to recognize this kind of stuff. It never goes away, I don't think. We always have stuff bubbling up in our mind. You know. So when I say I get discouraged, it's just little bubbles of discouragement. Yeah. You know. I know better. In the next moment, I'm not discouraged, and I'll just keep on going. It's the same for all of us. You know. So don't let any of that stop you. At least the big chunks of discouragement, we can get rid of those. Anything else? Yes?
When a teacher needs to impart information to students, is there a way that the teacher can do it in a more Dharma-like manner?
There's no formula, you know, there's no definite way, because it would be spontaneous with the moment. What's most important is that it's not intentional. The teacher's operating out of, oh, I gotta get them to do this or whatever. That you want to avoid that kind of stuff. But if there's something in the moment you can show this or that or direct their attention in some way, and then just let it go. You know, that's kind of how it's done. But how is that done? Any particular way? No, there's no formula for it, really. It's mostly a matter of just being present with what's taking place and then just kind of responding to that. And if possible, you know, just always moving toward clarity and enlightenment and not confusion. But that's about it. The teacher shouldn't be too deliberate or intentional. In fact, really shouldn't be at all. The main role of the teacher is just to live their life as like a bicycle rider. You ride the bike, and then in riding the bike, you can show how you ride a bike. And that's about it, you know. You try to get too much of the explanation about how to ride the bike, and you're just going to trip everybody up. No. So we kind of... It's frustrating, too, because then we think, well, the teacher should be in there. You know, we don't really understand the role of the teacher. you know, I think the teacher should be more hands-on and controlling, and like somehow the teacher owns the students, like these are my students or something like that. No. There's just students and there's teachers, and sometimes I'm a student and you're a teacher, you know. These things keep changing. That's the reality we live in. Of course, here they've slapped a title on me. I'm head teacher, right? So that really sounds like something, but not always. And not forever. Hoping at some point I can kind of step to the side. It'd be nice if I could step to the side while I can actually move my legs. But we'll see how that goes. I don't know. Anything else? David.
There's one aspect that there is a test. When you are not paying attention to reality, reality can catch you. Particularly, I find when I'm driving, if I'm not paying attention to reality, I get hit and hit somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but who's testing you?
Reality.
Yeah, well, if you say so. But we don't need to keep score, you know, like oh, boy, I was with reality in that moment, you know. No, in the next moment. So in the end, we can get rid of the testing analogy. Once in a while, I'll say there's a test, you know, but it depends. It depends on the situation, why I used it. But in the end, we shouldn't be too hung up on that. Because it isn't about getting scores and points and that sort of thing in the end. It's really very simple. It's just about being here. Either we're here or we're not. And we can talk about ways in which we get confused and things like that. Okay, anything else? Yes?
I was wondering, when you said that the masters say there's nothing to grasp, if that's a double entendre in that nothing has an existential quality of nothingness or suchness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. It's probably best to say nothing particular to grasp. Yeah. Because that's the thing. Yeah, we will form nothing and nothingness into something. And there's a lot of confusion in our teaching, too. We talk about emptiness a lot, and sometimes people end up equating that with nothingness. And we're not talking about nothingness. You know, because this is emptiness, for example, and we can't really say that's nothing. How can you say that's nothing? So we say emptiness. So we don't form the nothing into a particular entity. So if we say nothing particular, there is nothing particular to grasp. You can't get hold of anything in particular. Of course, we can get hold of things. We can get hold of ideas. I can get hold of this microphone. You know, we can get hold of things. But in the end, what have you gotten hold of? In the end, nothing particular. You see? So the getting hold of one thing or another is all going on in the world of samsara, you know? The world of relativity, the world of dukkha. But ultimately, that's not what's going on at all. We can't get hold of anything there. Seems like we can get hold of things. It seems like we can get hold of the teaching. That's why we keep reaching for it and grasping it. Well, what do you expect you're going to get hold of? And even of all the things that you do get hold of in the end, what have you gotten hold of? And we can never really find out. You know, what are you? Where are you going to go with that? We can start saying, well, my name is such and such, or I do this, or whatever. But in the end, we never get hold of anything. So in our minds, there's things particular that form. That's where our mind, that's conceptualizing. That's where we go. That's where we get trapped. That's where our mind is taken, like Takuan talks about. Our mind is taken by that. But why does he say nowhere to direct your mind? Because actually there's really nothing particular there. Once we realize that, we don't need to be taken by it. But we never reduce it to nothing. We never make it into something, and we don't reduce it to nothing. These are the Buddha identify these as the extremes of being and non-being. We avoid these extremes. Why? Because there's nothing really over there on either extreme. This is all about what's right here. what's right here can neither be grasped nor thrown away. Well, maybe that's enough for this morning. I better end it here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.